Hello and welcome to the NJBA podcast. This is episode 2, recorded March 2nd, 2006. I'm Steve Lubetkin, host of these podcasts. I'm managing partner of Lubetkin Communications, a strategic public relations counseling firm in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and the leading producer of business podcasts in New Jersey. In this podcast, we bring you the panel discussion sponsored by the ABA Marketing Committee of the New Jersey Bankers Association. The topic, Marketing to Nonprofits, a Profit Opportunity for Banks. The panelists are Duke Finelli, Vice President for Local Development for AXA Equitable Financial, and Nancy Keeling, President and Executive Director of the Princeton Area Community Foundation. If you have comments or suggestions about these podcasts, or if you'd like information on how we can help you create podcasts for your own business, please email us at steve@lubetkin.net. That's steve@lubetkin.net. We'd be pleased to receive audio comments as well, so feel free to send us an MP3 file. Now we'll turn things over to Dennis Kane of Amboy National Bank to set the stage for today's panel.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Dennis Kane. I'd like to welcome everyone to today's meeting and thank everyone for braving the weather. We were talking a little bit earlier, and 2 years ago we had two blizzards in a row, so we thought we had dodged the bullet, but not quite. A few commercials before we start. First, I would like to thank our sponsors. They really allow us to bring these programs to everyone at a reasonable cost. So if you haven't talked to any of the sponsors, please do so. And the Star Ledger and the Bergen Record are here, and they would certainly appreciate if everybody would increase their buys. And I think Joe and Jeff are saying there's a 75% discount for the next ad. Yes, is that correct? Yes. Okay, good. Great. Sure, exactly. We do have door prizes, and I think we have about 8 door prizes. They're really great items. So if you haven't given your business card to Jerry Lind, he has a mug up front. Please make sure you get your business card into the mug for the drawing. How we notify people, we've been trying to send out mailings, but recently we've been doing emails. So if we don't have your email address, please give your business card to Jerry Lind, and we'd like to email you. We also have established a new website. Damian Kane volunteered and created this for us, and it's www.njbankmarketing.com. So you can find out about our future meetings on that. Our next meeting is May the 4th. But someone also suggested that instead of just enrolling for one meeting at a time, they would like to be able to pay for a year in advance, so we can accommodate you for that too. You can just go to the website, enroll online, and we'll take care of that. One of the things we do, in addition to running education programs, is we try and provide networking opportunities for everyone. And this is done very informally. So if anyone has a position or anyone's looking for a position, you can contact me, and very informally we try and match people up, and it's worked very well in the past. The other thing is that I see a lot of our committee members or board members have braved the storm. We'll have a brief meeting right after. Unless we look out the window and it starts snowing a little bit, then we won't have a meeting right after. Okay. We're very informal. We had started this organization. Jerry Nussbaum in 1988 decided driving to New York or Philadelphia was a little far, and he suggested, why don't we get together a group of people and start our own New Jersey committee? And we did that in 1988, and it was Jerry's idea. So we thank Jerry for creating us. The other thing he suggested was, why don't we have a meeting for marketing to not-for-profits? And we all kind of turned around and looked at him and said, what are you talking about, marketing for not-for-profits? And it turned out to be a great idea, and Jerry put together the meeting for us today. So I'd like to introduce Jerry Nussbaum to run the rest of the meeting. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Dennis. I think I'm big enough to stay seated while I talk to you. To start things off, I'm going to tell you I've got some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that one of our speakers, unfortunately, is ill and is not here, and that's Irene Hannon of Citizens Bank in Philadelphia. She has offered to make her presentation available. So if any of you want her presentation, if you during our break, if you give me your business card and on the back just write Irene's presentation or Hannon presentation, I'll see that you receive it. The good news is that with Irene not here and the weather forecast being what it is, we'll probably get out of here a little earlier. So if you think that's good news, good for you. We're fortunate in having two very qualified and excellent presenters this morning. The first one is Duke Finelli. Duke is Vice President for Local Development of AXA Equitable. Duke is responsible for multicultural marketing, corporate sponsorships, activity, and local support for AXA Equitable's 60-plus branches throughout the country. Prior to joining AXA Equitable in 1998, Duke held a variety of positions over a 15-year period at JPMorgan Chase, supporting both the business and marketing aspects of the bank's retail business. He holds a BA in journalism from American University and worked as a journalist with Advertising Age. He is co-author of the Financial Services Marketing Handbook, one of our door prizes today, Tactics and Techniques That Produce Results, published by Bloomberg Press, and he teaches a financial services marketing course at NYU. Duke?
Thank you. Because of the PowerPoint presentation, I'm going to actually stand up here and go through the slides. What I'm going to talk to you about is something that's is a process driven way to look at how we're going. excuse me, how you penetrate the nonprofit market. And when I talk about nonprofits, it spans a lot of different things. I'm talking about municipalities, hospitals, school districts. It could be organizations, associations. So I'm going to try to keep it as broad as possible. And it really is going to be more of a discussion around market planning. How do you understand who it is you want to go after than the specifics around any one particular organization? One of my favorite quotes is, what's your objective? To sell more stuff to more people more often for more money more effectively. I mean, that's ultimately all of our goals in the room. Sergio Zimon now runs Zimon Marketing. He was the CMO, the Chief Marketing Officer for Coca-Cola. So that was his philosophy for years at Coke. And I think that ultimately sort of captures the essence of what we're all about. Today's discussion, two things. Identifying sales and relationship building opportunities in the nonprofit community through market planning. And then the second one, and I think most importantly, you can't get there without a plan. The whole planning aspect is going to be key to the discussion. Came up with a basic rule of the game, and this applies, I think, regardless of the type of business you're in. A solid market plan is critical regardless of the target market. Every target market that you go after should have a market plan against it. And when you reach out for the nonprofit community, all that changes is really the focus. The rules don't change. The need for a cohesive focus plan never changes. And that's just something that has been ingrained in me over the years. And I hope that in your business dealings that you kind of view things the same way. We do a lot of things. We do a lot of things where we do a lot of great planning. Think about your vacations that you plan. You either spend time on the internet, booking everything, making sure all your excursions, making sure everything is exactly right. But imagine taking that vacation, having everything done, getting in the car and not knowing where you were going. And that's essentially what we're talking about. We've identified who it is, where it is we want to go. We've identified who it is we want to go after. But we don't know how to get there. And there's some serious impediments in that kind of philosophy. The other thing that I think is important from our perspective as bankers, as financial services people, is understanding, and I know everyone in this room understands it, but I think it's worth repeating, is the psychology of marketing money. Financial services are about money, and money carries obviously a lot of psychological baggage. Their attitudes are highly emotional. Money's is very personal, so relationships drive the process. If I don't trust you, why would I give you my money? So trust is a large factor there. Consumers don't buy a brand, they buy you. We see this particularly true in insurance, but I know in banking, my 15 years of banking, the same thing. I mean, how many times do your customers tell you that their relationship is with the teller or their relationship is with the salesperson on the platform? You know, it's who they're comfortable with. Consumers have choices. How and when and where is up to them. I mean, clearly, you know, we do advertising, we do lots of marketing, but the bottom line is the consumer has the power to make the decision, and they make it basically when they're comfortable with the choices that have been presented. And cost, as I think all of you know, is not a differentiating factor in the buying decision. I mean, we've seen that in study after study, that, you know, it's convenience, it's service, it's a lot of things, but it may not necessarily be cost. So how does this all relate? So from your perspective, or from all of our perspectives, the target marketing process is really, really more or less five steps to it. And the steps are identifying the market. So there, if you were to look at it sort of from a step, a mission, a keyword, just so one word that you could tie to it, then sample activities, if we're going to identify the market, if it's hospitals, if it's municipalities, we want to specify the target market and why you've chosen them. Why is that an important market for you? Is it something that you want to do because, you know, you drove by a hospital and it's something you thought maybe we should be going into? Is it because you know somebody who's the mayor of a municipality and think you've got some business opportunities? You know, but is that really what's going to be ultimately driving the decision? So you identify the market, specify the target market. You do obviously some brainstorming around it. Evaluate and basically do what I'm sure everybody's familiar with: SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And do a SWOT analysis around that market and look at the potential there. From understanding the market, get to know the customer, and I'll talk about that quite a bit. I think regardless of who it is we're going to be going after, getting to know the customer and the customer needs obviously is critical. Without that, we really don't stand a chance. So the key there is you want to investigate. You want to look at your own customers who may be part of that particular market, may work for a nonprofit, may work for a particular hospital. You want to see what products do they own, what kind of value do they bring to the bank from a financial perspective. You want to interview people. You want to hold informal focus groups. You want to do surveys. Basically, you want to just immerse yourself in the market. Then once you've done those two things, you want to develop the plan. You want to decide what value you can bring. Clearly, that's a critical component. If you can't bring value, you know, you might as well just go away. I mean, no one's going to need you or your business if they're not seeing value in that. So part of that is the strategy. Part of that is the planning and developing the methods and systems where you can show and demonstrate value. Then the fun part, you want to implement the plan. Those are the tactics, right? Those are the things that make everybody really excited. So you want to communicate your value and solutions. You want to execute on it. And then you want to analyze the results, the toughest part of the whole process. Trying to figure out what metrics you're going to use, what's your ROI, what are you looking for in terms of a return here? You know, are you satisfied with less than a dollar for dollar return? Or are you looking for a 3-for-1 return? But that's all part of that all gets factored into whether or not I'm making a good, solid business decision, regardless of the market. So those are really the five initial steps. Excuse me. If you're going to look at, when you go from there, you want to value what's the value of the process overall. And the target marketing process, you know, 10 years ago when I was in banking, maybe 15 years ago, it was, you know, there was the shotgun approach versus the rifle shot. And the shotgun approach was, you know, if I pull the trigger, I'm going to hit something. It may not be what I want, but you know what, I'm going to hit something and that's okay for me. Clearly, the rifle approach is I'm going to focus and I'm going to be careful what I aim at because I want to hit what I aim. And that's really what the target marketing process is all about. So we want to identify the best opportunities for new sales, cross-sell, and upselling. part of that process, you want to identify key centers of influence. Who in the communities, in the nonprofit community, are the go-to people? Who are making the decisions? Who are the most influential within those communities? And you want to develop the relationships with them. It may be participating in a program that they're involved in. It may be inviting them to a function that you have at your bank. You know, there's a lot of ways to build the relationship, but you want to identify who those people are, because they will be critical as you go forward. You want to identify the media clearly. You know, if the Bergen Record and the Star Ledger are here, I'm sure they're running special supplements all the time that may make sense for you. Look at those supplements. Look at where it makes sense to advertise. Don't just say, you know, I want to be in the metro section every day if that's not who you're targeting. You really need to think about how best to reach those segments. Narrow the focus of your message goes to the whole advertising, the whole point of the advertising and any of the communication, and then increase the potential and this all will help increase the potential return on marketing dollars. And in this environment where marketing dollars in particular are tougher and tougher to come by and are always the first to get cut, we need to be able to demonstrate that we can increase the potential return so that we can make those marketing dollars go further. So, and again, I hope this isn't too simplistic for everybody, but I think it's worth repeating in some ways, because there are some things that people don't think about when even thinking about who they're going to target. If you're going to go after, again, I'll use the example of a hospital. If you're going to target a specific hospital, and you're going to say, all right, we want to do something around trying to get in and speak to interns or speak to residents or speak to the nursing staff or whatever it might be, you need to identify what in particular are you going to offer them and what in particular makes sense. So the first thing you need to have is, what is the common need of the group that you want to go after? If it's nurses, that may be a common need, but there are all sorts of nurses. There are specialists, there are general nurses, there are nurse practitioners, there are nursing assistants. So even there, you need to decide, what is it? I have to be as focused and narrowly focused as possible. Is it a manageable size? Are there 10 nurses? Are there 100 nurses? Or are there 1,000 nurses? Is 1,000 too big an audience to go after? Is 10 too small? Is it so small that it doesn't make sense for me from a financial perspective, even waste my time there? You have to want to do business with them. They have to meet your demographic profiles. They have to be making the income you want. They have to be the age you want. They have to have, basically, you know, are they the right, if you're looking for married people, are they married? If you're looking for single, are they single? So you need to do some thinking about all of that. And so to decide whether you want to do business with them. And probably the most important thing is, do they want to do business with you? You may go in there and think you've got the greatest program in the world, and they look at you and say, you know, just doesn't meet my needs. I think about my daughter and the way she shops. There are stores that I would go into that they may love to have her as a customer, she wouldn't think twice about. If I said to her, go buy something at Saks, she would look at me and probably not even know the name of the store. But if I said go to Neiman or if I said go to Nordstrom's, she'd probably be there in a minute. And then you need a common network of communication. How do these people like to be spoken to? Is it phone? Is it mail? Is it in person? Is it internet? Is it email? What's important to them from a communications perspective? So the question is, if the goal is to motivate a customer or prospect to act, then we have to ask ourselves, how do we identify the right sales efforts against the right target group using the right marketing activities to get the greatest return? And maybe the question will show up. Ah, there it is. Okay. And then the answer is, we have to know our customers by understanding what motivates them and what's immediately important to them. And when we talk about things that are immediately important, it really, I don't know how many of you are familiar with what I call a USA, unique selling advantage, or there's lots of different ways to describe it. But a unique selling advantage is basically your position, a statement about yourself, about your company, that answers the question, with all the choices that exist, why should I do any kind of business with you? And that's the answer that you have to be able to provide upfront to the customer. So if it's service, if it's rate, if it's new product innovation, if it's a ranking within the industry, if it's because you're known as an expert in that industry, that's basically your unique selling advantage. And the unique selling advantage can change. It can change daily, it can change weekly, it changes with the economic environment, it changes with your competitors, it changes with your competitors' unique selling advantages. But those are the types of things that you need to keep in mind. So what's this all mean in terms of nonprofits? So we need to take a walk in their shoes, and this goes back to understanding the customer. You have to understand what gets them out of bed in the morning, what excites and frustrates them about the business they're in. We have to build a knowledge base. And there's obviously loads of ways to do that. None of this is particularly revolutionary, but I think, you know, there's enough here that people can pull some aspects from. You know, attend the conferences and trade shows relevant to the target market. As you all know, you can find conferences and trade shows on any topic of interest. Read what they read. Subscribe to the business publications. Subscribe to the trade magazines. Understand what their business is all about. Hosted formal focus groups to understand what's important to them and how you can address their needs. We did that at Chase pretty effectively. We would invite people to a diner, you know, for breakfast, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, a group of 10 people, all in the same business. And in this case, it was small businesses, but invited them to the diner, had breakfast with them for an hour, said, you know, all right, what's going on in your industry? What's hot? What's important? What do you like about Chase? What don't you like about Chase? How can we improve our products? And we really began to build an understanding of what was going on in the small business community that way. And Chase has been for quite a while, and I assume still is, has a leader in small business lending. But you know, it was done pretty much from a grassroots level. Basically got in there and understood the customer. Then you also need to help them help themselves. Host networking events with potential contributors, with volunteers, with vendors, with industry experts. You have the resources and the clout to pull those kinds of people into an informal, you know, into a cocktail reception for a couple of hours, where it basically demonstrates to the person you're going after, to your market, that you care about what's happening, that you want basically to give them the tools they need to do the best job that they can do. And again, it's all about the relationship building. Advertising in industry and association magazines, you know, we see a lot of that, but remember, you have to use fresh creative. Don't use the same ad that you'd use in a general market in a targeted market. Clearly, you know, it's gonna show that you just didn't think about it. Participate as an exhibitor in the events they attend. Have corporate visibility at industry events, you know, buying tables, sponsor receptions, getting on the dais. That's one of the things that that we spend a lot of time at AXA doing, especially at a local level. And that is being very visible at industry events. Part of what we do when we look at sponsorships is we have to have a speaking opportunity, otherwise we don't get involved in the sponsorship. If we can't be up on the dais, even if it's 2 minutes, but if we can't be up on the dais talking about AXA, then we're just not interested. And I think that's key. Buying tables are great, you know, but you're competing with 50, 100 other tables in the room. You need to be up on the dais. People need to see you and recognize your name. You have to affiliate with the causes that are important to them. If you're dealing with whatever organization, find out from them, you know, what are their hot buttons? What makes them, what gets them excited? What are the causes that they are looking to best support? And then clearly the whole networking piece of that. I put this in at the last minute because I thought this was, it's a little out of sync, but I thought it was an important slide to just touch on. Because I've talked a little bit about how you need to get to know them, but there's also an internal aspect to all of this, and that's basically how do you leverage your target groups from an internal perspective, and there's a lot that you can do learning from your own customers. I'm sure you all have customers that in one way or the other either are in the nonprofit sector or are familiar with it, do business with it, whatever the case is. So learn from those customers. Have informal focus groups. Conduct the surveys. Do the one-on-one conversations. Use available information. Go into your customer database and understand what these customers buy. What's important to them? You know, what kind of accounts do they have with you? What kind of incomes? What kind of age? What kind? You know, what's their gender? I mean, there's just a whole load of great information that you can use as part of your analysis there. Again, knowing the products that they own, know the characteristics they have in common. Ask them why they became a customer. What's important to them? You know, did they become a customer because you were convenient? Did they become a customer because you have a reputation that they wanted to take advantage of? And then market to them how, when, and where it's convenient for them. We're seeing that everywhere we go, that the typical communication just isn't, I mean, and I'm sure you see it too, the typical communication just isn't working. There's so much clutter out there. There is so much competition. Everywhere you turn, you're competing with, you know, 5, 10 other, 20 other financial services companies all looking for the same, all with the same voice, all looking for the same exact customer. I mean, everybody wants 75,000, 100,000 in household income and above. I mean, that's not a tough target group to go after, and everybody's looking for it. So you need to know how to talk to them, when to talk to them, and when it's convenient to reach them. And then invite them to try on your shoes. You know, and we talked a little bit about this a minute ago. Once you get to know them, let them learn about you. You know, again, it's a relationship building experience. Host special open house events at your branch or office. Invite key influencers to events that you're sponsoring. Again, we do a lot of that where we just held something for Black History Month 2 days ago, and we invited some key influential African Americans in New York City to come to our event. Not because we were looking for business from them, but just because we thought that it's a good relationship building tool. Create specific material about your products and services that address their needs. Again, don't go in with a general market piece when they've got specific issues and concerns. And then this was, I thought, just kind of a clever little comic that appeared in The New Yorker, and it really talks about target marketing. My new marketing strategy is to sell stuff to you two. You know, it's like, is that what it's all about? It's like, you know, he understands who they are, and that's who he's selling. That's his market. And then there's five basically key market planning questions that I think need to be asked. And they are, you know, what are my key business objectives? What's the market potential? The company's priorities, clearly, whoever it is you're going after has to tie back to what your own company's priorities are. And then, again, you know, the whole question of how do you profitably retain and cross-sell existing customers while acquiring those high-value prospects? And then how do you implement to achieve the desired results? And that is really the outcome of your business plan itself. I guess one of the more important things there is the potential of the target group, I think, is really key to understanding in terms of a go, no-go decision. Because it may feel good and it may get people enthusiastic, but if you don't see the potential there, it probably just doesn't make sense, unless there are all sorts of outside political issues that you need to deal with, to go after a market that is not going to be profitable for you, is not going to have a profitable return. And then finally, and I think this applies to everything we do from a marketing perspective, today's marketplace is no longer responsive to the strategies that worked in the past. Too many products, too many companies, and too much marketing noise. And I think we need to, as bankers, figure out ways to get around all the marketing noise that's out there and create our own voice and create our own niche in those markets. So with that, I hope that gave you at least a flavor for market planning, and I hope it wasn't too simplistic based on your own experiences. But that's. I hope, as I said, I hope that was helpful for you. Thank you.
While Duke's presentation is still fresh in our minds, if there are any questions, why don't we... Yes?
Just picking up on what you were saying, that there's such a clutter from communication.
Lights.
But what are the... If you have your target market, what are the traditional tools you might use that still are effective or aren't, other than the... in-person meetings?
Well, I mean, you can certainly do mail and things of that sort, but it's got to be customized. You know, everything has to be customized. It has to have a direct voice to the person you're going to talk to. If they can't feel a connection with the mail, I mean, how much mail do you get at home that you just toss because there's no connection being made? And, you know, we toss it all day long. So there's that. I mean, some people prefer email over regular mail. Maybe email is the way to go. There are tremendous sponsorship opportunities that people get excited about going to because it's a unique experience that you can invite people to and have that, and it goes back to the one-to-one time. But sponsorships are a wonderful way. Dinners where there's a topic that's of particular interest to them, invite them to those types of things. Again, all relationship-building tools is, I think, what we need to look at.
Any other questions? Yes, Jim.
This is sort of my personal experience with marketing to not-for-profits. I found that probably the most effective way to get into and to be introduced to not-for-profits is through their board. Now, not-for-profits tend to create boards of directors from a wide array of businesses around the community. And I think that those members of those boards tend to be more involved. And if you happen to know a member of the board, or your company does business with that board member's company, who also sits on the not-for-profit board, that is a great way to get yourself introduced. I think that some of the traditional marketing approaches you presented here today are fine, but in terms of getting yourself into a serious conversation, the not-for-profit management tends to really pay attention to what the board has to say, and that's an area that I think.
I think you're absolutely right, and we encourage a lot of our salespeople to do that, not to get on boards for the sake of getting on boards. Obviously, you have to have an interest. You have to be able to dedicate the time, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a wonderful way to get a foot in the door, do something you care about, give back to the community. It does all the right things and potentially drives business. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I agree with the gentleman back there that the back door is kind of like the foundation board members. But I'm sitting here listening to a lot of things you're saying, and I can't help but think that any time we've gotten our way into somebody's doors by writing a check, and I hate to put it in terms like that, but I see it every day. It seems like the guy who writes the largest check, I'll ask, who do you bank with? And then they'll tell me who, and I'll look at the annual report, and they're like the largest contributor. And I'm just trying to be, you know, let's be real here, let's be realistic, that in many, many cases that I've encountered, it seems like that particular nonprofit, who they bank with is who is their largest contributor. And any time we've gotten our foot in the door is because we've written a check. And I hate to really put that in those terms, but I'm just trying to be real here. Mm-hmm. That many times you can send them all these nice things in the mail, you can invite them to receptions. It's who's in the picture with the big check has got the account. So, I mean, that's
yeah, and you're right. And I mean, absolutely. I mean, but, you know, but.
So I guess the question I'm going to ask our panel today is when you're up against someone, when you're up against a foundation with very deep pockets and you don't have the budget, how do you compete with the ones that the organizations that just write the checks? I mean, it's kind of frustrating at times. So that's why I'm here today, is find out, you know, what else could you do if you don't have the big budget?
Well, and I think some of the things I talked about is what you do. It is the relationship. Clearly, the dollars are going to drive decisions in a lot of cases. So maybe it's not the entire relationship. Maybe 60% of the relationship stays with the person that's writing the check. But if you're developing the relationship with the head of the with the executive director or their staff, and you're showing value, your bank is showing value, you've got outstanding service, you've got the products it needs, maybe you don't get it all, you know what, maybe it's not getting all the pie, maybe it's getting a piece of the pie.
Yeah, that's kind of the theme that when we go in, we try to say, well, you know, spread it out, like share the wealth and spread it around. And I like to think that happens, but...
You're absolutely right. I mean, clearly the check drives a lot of activity.
But because it kind of cuts through all that other nonsense of, let's get to the point. Here's our check. Let's set up the meeting with the CFO.
Can I just put my two cents in on that? I think follow the money. That old adage is important, no doubt. But I do think that it works when all other things are equal. then the person that the bank that writes the biggest check is the one that's going to get the business. But I think it's up to each of us in banking to prove that all things aren't equal, that we can provide you with more value than the guy down the street who might have written a larger check. But we can do more for you.
No, I agree. It's definitely the value proposition. So, in other words, just like how we all compete on price, but you compete on service, you compete on convenience. So it's not just who's got the best price. It's what are all the other things. So I agree, and I'd like to think that, you know, hopefully that the bank that did write the biggest check is giving them the best service. They do, in fact, truly have, you know, value there, and it's not just because of the zeros.
Well, I think that's the challenge a lot of us face, is to prove that we can do more for you than just write a check. Any other questions?
Just one other comment, Jerry. I think that in terms of your question with the beginning inside a not-for-profit, one of the things that I was doing for the bank, we had an internal graphics department. A lot of not-for-profits have a need to have their own fundraising efforts, flyers, brochures, created and printed. We would do that for them. I would take the graphics department within the bank. They would create all the graphics materials, brochures, for that not-for-profit at no cost. Those are the ways that you might be appreciated.
I'd like to make one more suggestion. There is a conduit into the world of nonprofits. There's an organization of attorneys that specialize in nonprofit tax law, about 125 of them, nationally, that meet in Washington, D.C. once a year. They have speakers from the IRS and other organizations that are important to them. Find out who the closest one to you is. These are the individuals who start a lot of the nonprofits, who get them tax exemption, who set them up, and who guide their banking decisions in many cases. So that might be a way to get into this world. Are there any other questions? Thank you again, Duke.
Oh, my pleasure.
We're going to take a short 10 to 15 minute break right now and visit with our sponsors. We'll be back in a few moments. I'm told that the weather outside is just rain. It's not snowing. There's no accumulation, so it looks like we're in pretty good shape. Before we get back into the program, I want to thank Steve Lubetkin, who is here and will produce a podcast of the program today, which will be effective at our website on or about Monday. Is that right, Steve? So if any of you want proof that you were here, you can go to the website on Monday. Our next speaker is Nancy Keeling, who is president and executive director of the Princeton Area Community Foundation, parenthesis, a nonprofit, close parens. During her tenure as president, PACF has grown from $300,000 in assets to over $40 million. Earlier in her career, Nancy worked as a corporate lending officer in the Communications, Entertainment, and Publishing Division of the Bank of New York, and as a regional director of admissions at Princeton University. She is currently the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Council of New Jersey Grantmakers, and a trustee of the Princeton Regional Chamber of Commerce. Nancy has a BA in history and an MS Ed from Old Dominion. And we're very pleased to have her here today. Nancy.
Thank you. Thank you and good morning. Thank you for staying. I want to start by thanking you for your interest in the nonprofit sector. And I also want to say that in my shop, we often refer to the nonprofit sector not as such, but as the public benefit sector. And I would propose to you that the nonprofit sector is the only part of our economy that we refer to by what they don't do. And what they do provide is public benefit. We operate to provide benefit to the public, or to some subset of the public. I give that to you to and challenge you to think about that and the implications that that has for how you view the sector and what it does. We don't work just not to make a profit. In fact, we love it when we don't see any little of those parentheses at the bottom of the page. I want to start by telling you a little bit about what I do to set the stage, because in running a community foundation, there are four in New Jersey. There are about 700 around the country. New Jersey lags the nation in community foundations. Community foundations are public charities subject to the public support test, which we'll talk about in a little bit. We operate as an umbrella organization. We attract resources, generally long-term endowments held for a community, a regional community's good. We are investment managers and we are grant makers. So I tell you that. I've given you a copy of our annual report. If you look at our website, there's a great deal of information about us, but also about the nonprofit sector and the community foundation world. Just by way of saying, we absolutely operate as a nonprofit. We are also grant makers, so we have that kind of relationship with the rest of the sector, that relationship that you talked about, writing the check. We write a lot of checks and have a sort of an overview of public benefit organizations as a result, while we are also one. And we also interact with the foundation community, because we are a foundation, although somewhat different from private foundations and the large national foundations, the one here in New Jersey being the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So that's kind of a segue into, I didn't bring the PowerPoint electronically, but I have printed it out for you, and we're going to use this as a basis, and you can take it along with you. Sort of a segue into the first piece here, which is, who are nonprofits? And I would propose to you that the public benefit sector is just as diverse and complex as the for-profit sector, and can't really, in a sense, be talked about as one. Duke touched on this, that, you know, we're talking about everything from small mom-and-pop startups, soccer leagues, PTAs, all the way up to the Princeton University's Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's ETS, Educational Testing Service, to name some New Jersey folks, as well as the large national charities, the American Red Cross, and then on into the international realm when you have operations here in the U.S. that operate around the world, like CARE, or the International Rescue Committee, or those sorts of organizations, radically different in terms of how you as bankers might approach them. In New Jersey, there are more than 25,000 nonprofit organizations, up 63% between 1996 and 2003, so a fast-growing sector. And within that sector, only 11% of those 25,000 have annual operating budgets of $1 million or more. And what do I have here? 68% have budgets under 100,000. So you're really talking about the majority of the sector are really very small. And in targeting your market, you may have to make some decisions about, is that good business? Do you want to go after that? Is it worth writing the big check? The public benefit sector is a dynamic force. It accounts for about 10% of the workforce. It holds $59 billion in assets in New Jersey. Now, I would footnote that by saying probably 9 or 10 of those billion are at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and another 11 or 12 billion of them are at Princeton University. Take those two, those two organizations alone kind of skew New Jersey numbers. 272,000 people work in the public benefit sector in New Jersey. Where I work in Mercer County, our largest employers are Merrill Lynch and Bristol-Myers Squibb. And after them, I would say the next 5 or 6 largest employers are all nonprofits. Princeton University, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Educational Testing Service, 5 hospitals, before we even get to organizations my size and smaller. So a very diverse group, but a lot of people out there. In New Jersey, there are currently about 2,400 foundations, which are also nonprofit organizations, have banking needs, are much more, private foundations are much more closely held. And when, we're going to talk later about how you can learn, you can actually learn a lot about these organizations off of publicly available information. How are we different? I would suggest to you that in the public benefit sector, our ownership clearly is very different. We are owned essentially by the public. Because we don't pay tax, and there are tax advantages to individuals and corporations in giving to us, the ownership I feel in my work that I am working in the public trust, that, that everything we do is and should be very accessible and visible, and that I'm reporting to an entire community. Closer into home, we are essentially the board of trustees have the legal and fiduciary responsibility for the organization. So the day-to-day operations in my organization, the buck stops with me, but the really big issues, the buck stops with the board. And I think that's an important thing for you to understand. Staff of nonprofit organizations, many of them are first and foremost authorities in the field that they work in, whether that's social work, healthcare, education, the environment, the arts. And they may or may not be business people. So that when you go to work with them, take that along, along with you. We also operate under professional standards that you can see. Actually, some of them are on our website if you want to look at them. For example, in your world, a salesperson is often paid a commission. In my world, a fundraiser, it is unethical for a fundraiser to be paid any kind of commission on funds they raise, because it sets up an inappropriate relationship with a potential donor. I've sprinkled some tips through this presentation, and the first one actually comes from the CEO of a local nonprofit who said, "We appreciate bankers who appreciate what we do and don't assume we're stupid." I have worked, as you can tell from my resume, on both sides of the profit for profit world, and there's a lot of misunderstanding one side to the other. Ultimately, I think we're all just hardworking folks trying to help each other. This particular individual used to be a rocket scientist and now runs a soup kitchen. And I guess in his experience has been approached sometimes as if he didn't know much about business. Who are the decision makers? The decision maker changes a lot depending on the size and longevity, sort of where an organization is in its life cycle. Many organizations start, clearly many stay at the stage where they are entirely volunteer run. So you may be marketing to someone who is a volunteer, a trustee, or just a volunteer. I've spent many years as the treasurer of a nursery school, as a parent, as the treasurer of a soccer team. I seem to always get the checkbook. So you may be talking to somebody who does something very different for a living and may or, it'll vary how much responsibility they really feel toward that role that they play. To divide this up very simplistically, in kind of medium-sized organizations, you are most likely the decision maker will be the executive director, CEO person, who, as I mentioned before, may be first and foremost a social worker, not a business person, but smart. And in large organizations, obviously, if you go to a hospital, to Princeton University, you're talking to finance staff. And in those, many of those cases, very highly skilled finance people, chief financial officers, who have long resumes and really know what they're doing. Duke mentioned some ways to meet folks in the sector, and I totally concur. We go to Chamber of Commerce meetings. We go to Rotary meetings. I would reach out to them, invite them to share a seat at your table. Many, particularly small to mid-sized nonprofits, don't have money for these kinds of things in their budget. They love to go to them because they like to network as much as you do, and they just love you for calling up and saying, "How would you like to be our guest at the next Chamber of Commerce luncheon?" Or if you are taking a table at another nonprofit's dinner event or lunch event. Invite them to come along. Great way for them to feel wonderful about you and also to sit and talk to them and build that relationship. Volunteer. I think many corporations really encourage their employees to volunteer, and it's a great thing to do. It doesn't have to be the marketing person. It doesn't have to be the frontline banker. Building that relationship with a nonprofit can happen through many different people in your organizations. Invite them to your events. We regularly attend events that are given by our bankers and investment managers because we're their customers and we know that we're important customers to them, and also because we want to meet their other customers. I would totally concur that trustees are a key way into the sector, particularly with small and mid-sized organizations. I will tell you that in my organization, when I arrived, we were 2.5 years old, and the banking relationship was with Core States Bank because their retired chairman sat on my board. We no longer bank with them. They still give to us. And we have a consulting relationship with now Wachovia. And our primary local banking relationship is with a bank, PNC, that we have had two successive officers of the bank on our board. Not so much because they were PNC people, but because they were wonderful trustees, and they are wonderful members of the community. And we bank with them. It's also convenient. They also give us good fees. There are a variety of reasons for that relationship. That story I also want to point out indicates we've changed bankers. Jack Wallace, who happens to be the former president of New Jersey National Bank as it became Core States, has always said, you know, the minute I retired, they stopped returning my calls. Those relationships can change depending on who you have. Where do the resources that nonprofits have come from? I'm going to walk you through the tax return of a nonprofit in a minute, and you will see that there are 11 sources of income that are listed on an IRS 990 form. And I've bulleted them here. You all can read. I don't need to walk you through that. The point is, these are complex businesses with a lot of different kinds of income, and you may want to target some of your services differently to different of those streams of income. For example, you're talking about a large national charity, you may want to go in and sell them lockbox services because they do a lot of direct mail fundraising. And they need a really efficient way to bring that in and get it into their account. Where, you know, a small mom and pop on the corner wouldn't even know what a lockbox was. I would say small organizations choose their banker based on convenience and relationships. If they're sharp business people, they'll also push you on price. As they grow, they may change banks as they move their office, so convenience maybe becomes a different issue, or they're looking for additional services or other kinds of support. And for large organizations, it's a very corporate decision. I don't know that side of Princeton University, but I have to assume they have multiple banking relationships, just as a large corporation likely does. The comment earlier about, you know, it seems that people bank with the one who writes the big check. I think there is a lot of truth in that. The sector is very appreciative and generally very friendly with banks. Because you are generous to them. Across the board, banks are generous to them. If you look through our annual report, you'll see a number of banks who give to the community foundation in one or more ways. If I can digress and tell you a story for a moment, PNC Bank, with whom we bank, also maintains a fund at the community foundation. They have a large foundation out of their East Brunswick office. They channel a modest amount of those dollars through the community foundation. They make local grants in the Princeton market to nonprofits. They host a breakfast every December when those grants are given out. And it is probably one of the best feel-good marketing things they could ever imagine doing. They fill the room with probably 80 to 100 nonprofits, trustees, staff, a good mixture. They hand out really small grants, $500 to $1,000 grants. They feed everybody bacon and eggs. Their spouses aren't there to tell them not to eat them. And the nonprofits love being in the room with each other. They rarely get the chance to do that. Their lives are too busy. They make connections. They build relationships with each other that often helps their work. And they love PNC. And PNC is very straight with them that they will grant to them for 3 years. And if within that 3-year period of time, they don't become customers of the bank, don't look to us for a grant again. And they're very upfront about that. So it goes both ways. That they're looking to, you know, they're looking to be most generous to those who bank with them. And is the horse before the cart, or the chicken, the cat's chasing its tail? I don't know, but it goes both ways. What do we need? Our needs are as diverse as the sector is. Basically, we need good banking services at a good price, and we need bankers who are responsive. For the first time this past year, we needed to take on the capability to have a credit card system. We had have a donor who is an artist who gave us a big piece of his collection, and we're in the process of liquidating it, selling it. If any of you are interested in a Tom George painting, call me. And we needed that facility to be able to do that. Who did we call? We called PNC. And they came and they trained us and they took our phone calls and they went the extra mile to help us incorporate this service. Shortly after that, we had another fund at the Community Foundation that wanted to use the credit card service, but it was in much more of a small transaction, high volume, with us not on site. And the first thing we did was call our friends at PNC and say, how's this going to work? Can we do this? Is there another way to work this out? How does this part of the business operate? Because we don't know that. We're smart, but we don't know that. And they were really helpful, and we actually found another way to handle that. But the point is, they went the extra mile to teach us, to help us use the system that they'd put in place with us. I've given you a list of the kinds of services that nonprofits use. And at the end of it is investment. Many nonprofits, as you can see, with $59 billion in assets, have significant investments. And they vary a lot on how they invest those funds. Some of that decision depending on the sophistication of the organization and obviously how much they have. In our world, there are many grants, particularly government grants, sometimes large foundation grants, that actually require, as a condition of the grant, that the funds be held in a separate bank account. So particularly probably those of your customers who have government grants, it's a piece of, I think Duke touched on it, to know our business and when there are opportunities for you. So how can you learn more about this sector in the kinds of ways that that you all have the skill and the need for? And I would suggest that the richest resource for you is to review the tax return of nonprofits. If you bank really large public companies, there are SEC filings and other pieces of information that are available to you. If you bank private companies and little companies, you probably have a hard time getting as complete a picture of their business as you might like. But in the case of nonprofits, we all file a 990, which is actually called an informational return because we don't pay tax. But there is a lot of information we have to report annually, and it is all out on the web. The IRS is about to require nonprofits to file electronically, in which case it will get out on the web much more quickly. Because right now there's a year to 2-year lag on that information, but I think it's still valuable to you. A 501c3 public charity files an IRS 990. A private foundation files a 990-PF. On the last slide, I've given you some resources and the link to the IRS website. You can actually pull down those forms, you know, blank forms, and the instructions so you can see what's there. But we're going to walk through a couple pieces of it. And I've pulled out kind of the information I think is most relevant to for you. I've also given you some websites where you can find them. Probably the most notable being GuideStar, which you may have heard of. You may also want to look at some of this information if you are personally, individually, in your family, a donor to an organization. So the first thing you're going to learn right up top is the identity of the organization and its tax status. There's a line that asks, it says 501c, and then it has parentheses where they fill in whether they're a 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 501c3s are those nonprofits that allow, that where a gift to them is tax deductible. There are many other kinds of organizations that are tax exempt, but where a donation to them is not deductible. Chambers of Commerce, many Rotary clubs. That's why you see oftentimes those organizations are a C4 or C6, and they have a C3 attached to them so that they can take in donations and issue a tax deduction for that. So you'll see, are they a C3? Right up at the top, you'll see whether they do their accounting on a cash or accrual basis. You'll see what their fiscal year is and whether it's an initial return or a final return. If it's an initial return, you're well aware of the fact that you're not getting much information. It may only be a few months. It's a startup, and it may be hard to tell. If it's a final return, obviously they're going out of business, so you're probably not going to look to bank with them. The next major part of the front page, it was too bulky to make 70 copies, but that's basically what the front page of a 990 looks like. And all these lines are these 11 forms of income. It starts with direct public support, which is you and me writing a check, and you includes U.S. banks. Goes to government support, particularly in healthcare, in human services. Probably 80% or more of the dollars that flow into a human service organization come from government. Program service revenue is what they might charge. If it's Princeton University or, a local private secondary school, that's tuition. But it might be that they charge for services. It's a counseling agency, and maybe they have a policy that they won't turn anyone away, but they have a sliding scale, and that's the fee they charge for their service. Membership dues. How many of you have become members of a zoo, a museum, some kind of organization that you get then free entrance or 10% off in the gift shop or whatever? Membership is an important source of income for many. Gross sales of inventory, rents, special events. In my world, we call special events special opportunities to lose money. Oftentimes, you'll see a negative number there. Sales of assets other than inventory will give you an indication of what on yours and my personal tax return turns up as a capital gain. So that'll show you if there's a lot of activity in investment accounts. And they may have inventory. They may sell T-shirts. They may have a gift shop. So they may actually sell inventory. And then the 11th category is other. Use your imagination. So then you get down to a total revenue number. And this is all right on the front page of a 990. You'll see then their expenses broken out into three categories. Program services, management and general, and fundraising. There's a lot of talk in our sector about being efficient around fundraising and about management expenses so that most of the dollars go to program services. When you're making a gift, you probably want to see that it's really going to the activity that you most want to support. It's a controversial area. I read a lot of 990s when I have my grantmaker hat on, and they vary enormously. And I would caution you, I always run some ratios on those numbers. I look at what they spend on management in general and fundraising relative to their total costs. I also look at their fundraising costs relative to, I go back to the front page, and I look at it as a percentage of total gifted income, which is direct public support, government grants, things they had to go out and either write a proposal for or do a direct mail campaign for, or whatever. Sometimes you'll see what looks like a very high expense in this current year, but when you look back at the first page, you'll see a higher than usual income And if you look at two or three tax returns in a row, you'll figure out that, oh, they're in the middle of a capital campaign. And often in a capital campaign, there are high costs in the first year, and the money starts coming in years two and three, and it really isn't high cost. But it might look like that if you only look at 1 year. So that's a more than you wanted to know, perhaps. At the bottom of the front page, you'll see the excess or deficit for the year, their beginning year assets, and their end of year assets. So it'll give you a sense of, you know, they bring in $5 million a year, they spend three, they put two into the bank, and they've actually got $20 million at the bottom line. They have some endowment, they have some resources, they're not going out of business. That net asset number's going up. This is a viable organization with a future. As you go on through the next page, we'll break out those program management and fundraising expenses. And if they have anything on the first line in direct public support, there should be fundraising expenses. Sometimes there isn't. I find in my world, there's still many accountants who don't fully understand nonprofit accounting and don't do it quite right. There is a page that asks what their primary exempt purposes are. You get to find out what do these folks actually do, and there's a dollar amount attached to that, so you can see the relative weighting of different activities within the organization. There is a balance sheet. So you can look at that the same way you'd look at many balance sheets. What I would like to point out is that when you get down into the asset category, you will see that nonprofits account for their assets as unrestricted, temporarily restricted, or permanently restricted. And what that means, it's all kind of accounting language, what that means is unrestricted funds are funds where there is no restriction by the donor, by the organization, on the use of those funds, when or for what. Those are the funds that nonprofits love to have. Temporarily restricted assets, they may also love to have, and you may from time to time see large numbers there because they may do a capital campaign, bring in $10 million to build a new wing on the hospital, and it's temporarily restricted for the building of that wing. Can't be used for anything else, and it's a temporary restriction because the building's going to get built and the money will get spent. Permanently restricted assets are those where a donor has said you may not use the principal or some portion of the principal. So there is a permanent restriction on those funds. Generally what's thought of as endowment, where you're only spending the income or a percentage of the funds. So something that's important to see, because if you look at this over two or three years, you'll see some flow between those categories as temporarily restricted assets go into unrestricted and then out the door. Nonprofits have to report the compensation for the five most highly paid officers and directors. There are many private foundations that pay their trustees. Public charities typically do not pay their trustees. Might be a flag if you saw that. But usually someone in my position is considered an officer of the organization, even though I'm not a member of the board. I am considered an officer of the organization, so my compensation shows up there. It's really a fun world to be in. Everybody knows your business. But you will see, and in large organizations, you'll see all five filled in. If it's a small organization, or if many of their staff make less than 50,000, this requirement only applies to people who make 50,000 and above. But it'll give you some idea of the payroll. There is another place on the 990 where it asks for the five highest paid employees other than officers and directors. So you'll see that, and you will also see who they pay for professional services and consultancies. So they may have a direct mail business that they work with. They may have an attorney, an accountant, marketing, and you'll see who has relationships. This is all about relationships, folks. Who has relationships with them in their consultancies. You will also find on, I think, page 7, the number of employees. I think, Duke, you talked a lot about, you know, you want to go bank with the nurses. And there may be 100, there may be 1,000. They may differentiate across their professional expertise. But clearly, you may want access to some of their employees. And you'll see, I just read the tax returns just this week. of the American Museum of Natural History and the Wildlife Conservation Society, which is the Bronx Zoo and the New York Aquarium, and they both have 1,600-1,800 employees. They're big organizations, lots of folks there. So point out that you can learn that. Let's see. In a nonprofit organization, you won't get any information off the tax return about their investments. If you're looking at a private foundation 990PF will give you incredible detail about their investments. So you'll see right down to what stocks they're invested in. If you're interested, you know, that's just sort of a fascinating world, go for it. And some of them are on GuideStar, and you'll find many of them on the Foundation Center's website, or on another one that I listed for you called GrantSmart. I would suggest to you this is a marvelous resource for you to look at. I look at them all the time as a grant maker. We always look at the financial viability of an organization we are looking to grant to. And as a fundraiser, we look at private foundation tax returns all the time, because they fund us. So again, I've given you these linkages so that you can go look at them. And the last one actually is a link to the Community Foundation's website. We have a resources and links page that has all of these links on it, and is actually divided into three portions, one for donors, one for nonprofits, and one for professional advisors. Community foundations work a lot with gatekeepers, with bankers, with investment managers, with financial planners, trust and estates attorneys, accountants, people who sit at the table when people of means are making decisions about the disposition of their wealth. And so our website can be a good portal for you to go to these others and click through to them. So I am really happy to take any questions that you have about the sector in general, to the extent from my own personal experience, how we think and operate, and then we can all go home early. I realize I'm like the lunch speaker, you know, who stands between you and dessert. I stand between you, and it sounds like sleety, but we'll hope it's better than that.
Yeah.
Questions? Yes.
Nancy, a lot of not-for-profits have taxable income.
That's right.
Can you talk about that for just a moment?
Yeah, it's called unrelated business income, UBIT. Some of them try and avoid it because it has tax consequences. You know, my parents taught me a long time ago, don't be afraid of paying taxes, it just means you made money. If they do something that generates income that is not part of their exempt purpose, they have to pay tax on it.
Like Reader's Digest?
Right. Selling a magazine.
Yeah.
If all the proceeds of that magazine go to fund the exempt purpose, then maybe they don't pay tax on it. But yes, and larger nonprofits, many of them will have unrelated business mm-hmm. income. Mm-hmm. It doesn't flow through to those, the exempt purpose that you'll see on the 990. Mm. Yes.
Can you just go back to something you started to talk about in the beginning, where your banker was on the board, then he went, when you took over, then he went off. What can you describe what really led to your changing of bankers at that time and what the main criteria were?
I would say it was in part his waning engagement with the former bank. New Jersey National was bought by Core States, was bought by First Union, was bought by Wachovia, the typical story. And we still have a relationship with Wachovia, but it's more one where we actually consult with them on one of their grant programs, and they are donors to the foundation. And we had, at the same time, we had PNC bankers who we knew well, who were convenient to our office, who for a while were also investment managers, who could offer us, I mean, Wachovia could have also, quite frankly, but, weren't near where our office was. I would say in our case, it probably really was, predominantly a relationship issue. And PNC was generous, to us just at the level of banking fees and the like. They do a nice job with nonprofit organizations. We had a very good relationship, through many people in that bank, not just the individual who was on our board. And I would also say that PNC in our market is extremely generous with their people and their funds. So there are a lot of PNC people who sit on a variety of boards in the region. So a lot of people know them. When First Union bought Core States, I was at an event, you know, at the Hyatt, and a woman I know, she happens to now be on our board, who works at ETS, looked at a First Union banker and said, "Are you guys as generous as Core States? Because that's why I bank with them." And that wasn't ETS's banking, that was her personal banking. So for some generous individuals, that is also something they watch, is how responsive is this bank to my community? Because beyond banking with the organization, there are lots of opportunities to bank with its constituency, its clients, its board, its staff. It's a conduit. Yes?
Do you look to the banks to manage any of your endowment funds?
We have one relationship locally at the moment. Most of our funds are held by institutions way outside of our region, because our responsibility now is to a more sophisticated level of investment management, and it's led us in some other directions. We have a fairly complex asset allocation plan, and it's not something that the banks necessarily can respond to. So a good chunk of our money, for example, is in mutual funds and various places. So we have, and I would say we're probably more like the really large organizations in terms of investment issues, and more like a mid-sized organization in terms of our banking. You had a question.
One of your tips identifies for nonprofits a potential need for segregated accounts for grant making. That sounds like something very unique for nonprofits. Are there other unique sort of services or needs that you think nonprofits have that might be segmented small, medium, or large?
I would say there's a lot of business in lending to nonprofits for in construction loans, things like that. A lot of nonprofits are major holders of real estate from the building they operate in, but some of them are housing organizations or universities, hospitals. The Princeton Hospital is about to build a new $350 million hospital. Big lot of construction going on. And they may have equipment needs that they look to borrow for or maintain a line of credit for. And in those ways, that's really not that different from a for-profit. Your analysis of their ability to pay you back may be a different analysis because they make their money differently. But if it's an organization that's been in business for a long time and you review their work over many years and you see constant or slightly increasing revenues, you can be reasonably comfortable that will continue, barring some horrible change. I think in many ways it's really not that different. Yes.
How would you identify? You kind of talked about who the decision makers would be based upon the size of the organization. To communicate with them. Is it really a one-on-one basis as opposed to anything else? I mean, you have direct marketing, obviously, you could mail to them, but to try and find out who they are isn't so easy. But how do they really respond more to that one-on-one sales call or somebody being on their board talking about a potential bank service that they could use? How does that actually work in reality?
My most valuable comments to you will be about organizations from small to mid-sized, because that's the run I've had. And as I said earlier, I have to assume that a Princeton University is a very corporate kind of environment around these kinds of issues. In my world, I wear about 12 different hats, from fundraiser to grant maker to manager to HR director to IT, a whole bunch of stuff I don't know much about, and I've had to learn. Also custodian, I should throw in there. But I'm pressed for time. And unless my relationship, our relationship with our bank is a critical component of efficient and smooth operations. And at this point, I am loath to change that unless there were some whoppingly good reason. So for me personally, sitting at my desk of an average day, a cold call goes into voicemail and does not get returned. So it's all about relationships. And that may be something that builds over time. By sitting with me at the Chamber of Commerce lunch, by inviting me to an event, to just building a relationship. Because right now we have a system set up that's very efficient from a cash management standpoint, as well as its interface with our investment pool. And that's really important to us. And, I was a banker at one time, and, most of our customers didn't just jump banks. I have seen banks offer grants to nonprofits, the big check. We call them the grin and grab. If the nonprofit will bring their banking business. And my advice to my nonprofit colleagues is to shut out that request, because for a nonprofit to constantly, they jump banks for this $5,000 grant, it doesn't make any sense. It's disruptive. And if you see a nonprofit doing that, even if they will bring their business to you, watch out for the next guy who writes the $6,000 check, because they'll probably be gone. But it's not good business practice for a nonprofit.
Most small to medium-sized organizations just have one banking relationship then?
Yeah. I would think they wouldn't get into multiple banks till they get significantly larger. And then you might start a new relationship with them at the point that they need to take on payroll services or something, and you do that rather than start with it all starts initially when they're small with a deposit relationship. That's all there is. But as they grow and need some other things, you may come in on one of those product lines as opposed to and then if they like you, over time they may bring some of that other business to you. But with online banking nowadays, for example, we have several accounts at PNC, and it allows us to move money back and forth within them quickly and easily, which we would lose if we had multiple banks. So, once you're in and providing good service and making that kind of thing easy for them, it makes it harder for your competition to come in. Yes.
One more question. Of the banks that you interact with or have interacted with, do they have a dedicated individual or group? And how important is that?
We actually, as an office, we have probably three or four people at PNC that we interact with regularly. We have a problem. We have certain pieces of business that go through this one as opposed to this one. So it's a relatively small group, tight group, and they're all working out of the Princeton office, even though we may walk in and out of a variety of PNC branches around the area, and we do a lot of our banking online.
But they're not specifically dedicated to nonprofits.
No, we work with the person who kind of manages the region, we currently have the senior VP for PNC Advisors is a member of our board, and then there are people in the branch that we deal with regularly. And they can be really helpful. Last year we had someone who wanted to wire a gift in from Switzerland. Not something we do every day. So, needed wiring instructions so that goes smoothly. Because for us, that's a donor services opportunity. If we mess that up, we make that an unpleasant or difficult experience for the donor, we'll never see them again. In this case, it happened to be a family member of a board member. That's the piece I think, Duke, you talked about a lot, is understanding our business. That many of our income streams are hard-won, and they come with really important relationships attached to them for us. And the reason why we're cheap when it comes to any services that we look for is because those dollars are so hard-won. donated dollars, every time I look to spend money, I think, what does it take to bring in that $100,000, $200,000, $5,000, $10,000? What do we have to do to bring those resources in so that we can spend them? It's really hard work. And like your work, that is all about relationships. And our banking services need to support that and make that seamless so that we can maintain those good relationships too. Anything else? Thank you all for staying in crummy weather. I actually don't hear anything out there at the moment.
Drive carefully. We hope to see you on May 4th. Good. And thank you all for coming today.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast presentation brought to you by the New Jersey Bankers Association and its ABA Marketing Committee. If you'd like further information about the New Jersey Bankers Association, please visit our website at www.njbankers.com or the ABA Marketing Committee website at www.njbankmarketing.com. Once again, if you'd like information about how to make podcasting part of your business communications, or if you have comments for us on these programs, please drop us an email. The address is steve@lubetkin.net. That's lubetkin.net. We produce the podcasts in our studios in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. For the New Jersey Bankers Association and its ABA Marketing Committee, this is Steve Lubetkin. Have a great day, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.